This is music from Joe Feidler's Big Sack Butt. Welcome to The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson. The jazz trombonist goes baroque with his all-brass ensemble. But as we'll hear, Feidler's music is quite modern. Pianist Randy Weston and saxophonist Billy Harper trace the roots of the blues in our performance studio. And speaking of the blues, the author of Blues People, Amiri Baraka, celebrates the 50th anniversary of his groundbreaking book about the genesis of jazz, rock, all popular American music as we know it. That's up first. You're listening to The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson. Thanks for checking in. Fifty years ago, a major book was published. It was called Blues People. It was written by someone named Leroy Jones. Amiri Baraka is with us. He is the author of Blues People, The Negro Experience in White America, and the music that developed from it. Amiri Baraka, what gave you the impetus to write Blues People?
I'd have to give the first, wave to my English professor, A.B. Spellman. You might have heard of him as a writer. He's a poet. Anyway, we were roommates at Howard, and, we thought we were so hip, that we knew everything. We heard Charlie Parker and Monk. I mean, we got so hip, we heard Dave Brubeck, Jazz at Oberlin. That's when I was in college. See how long ago that was. And Brown, who was my English professor, who was a very profound guy, he said, "You all know all about the music, come to my house, I'll show you something." So we went over there. He had walls of records, 78s mostly. I think 45s was just coming out. I mean, he was playing blues, old blues. And he said, "That's your history." I didn't really understand it thoroughly till about 10 years later. They're telling you their lives. That's what the blues are. They keep telling you about their lives, where they came from, where they're going, what they expect, what life is like. So if you want to understand black history, you understand your own self's history, check out the blues. So when I got to New York, after flunking out of Howard, joining the Air Force, getting kicked out of the Air Force, it was two for two. I went to New York, and I got a job downtown at a place called a Record Changer, and it was a joint, really, where you would say the Moldy Figs hung out. They're really actually young white dudes who like Dixie, that's what they call it, Dixieland, So I was looking for a job. I went in there, I told the guy, I said, "Well, I don't know much about the music before Louis Armstrong." The guy said, "No one else does either." And I was the all-purpose shipping clerk, Not only had I to locate the records among these thousands of records, but I had to grade them. And I learned the old labels, Jeanette, Vocalion, Black Swan, all that. I learned who the stars of those records were. And I learned the history of the blues. And that was my gig. And that's how I learned it. So the interesting thing about that was a whole bunch of young white jazz critics hung there. Martin Williams, what's his name, who was the head of the Institute of Jazz Studies?
Dan Morgenstern.
This is where they hung out. I was in there packing, they was in there. And we sit rapping all afternoon because they wasn't doing nothing. I don't know what they was doing. They was in college or this kind of job or that kind of job.
Give me a sample conversation. You say you were rapping. What would you guys be talking about?
Well, some of the stuff that turned out to be problematic to me, like Morgenstern would say, jazz stopped after Duke Ellington. And I said, "Wait a minute, man. I'm a bebopper, first of all, so that can't be true." Or Martin Williams, who was my close friend, Martin said, you know, Billie Holiday wasn't a blues singer. But what are you talking about, man? But anyway, those kind of conversations would go on half of the day. There were some really heavy minds in there. And we talked, we talked, we talked. But what I found out is that I had different ideas about it. You know, for instance, I do think Billie Holiday is a blues singer. You know, I argued that it's not a form, Martin. It's not a form, it's a feeling. The form, that's formalism. You know, you could say, you could go 12 bars, A, B, A, B, and it won't be the blues if it don't have that. You know what I mean? And as far as jazz being dead, Dan, you know, that's just not real. I mean, you like that. But to tell me that Bird and them are not jazz is just not realistic. You know, I don't know. He altered his views later on, obviously. But they were good friends of mine, and the back and forth discussions, you know, with people who knew what was happening, you know. I have to clarify what I think about this. And so I began that year, it was 61, 62, to listen to blues all day, every day. From the oldest I could get through each period and begin to then classify them, understand them, you know. And then I wrote out the kind of précis, the kind of outline that I wanted to talk about, you know. First of all, how did Africans get to be Afro-Americans?
When did a black American emerge, as
exactly,
you wrote?
Exactly. And that was, obviously, that for me, that was key right there. When do you, and can you tell that from the music? Obviously, if you listen to the music, you could tell it. The African forms, which are primary at one point, begin to recede. Because what was important to me is, when did the African slave become the American slave?
I've had a man of 15 years, give him his room and board. Once he was like a hell like, now he's like an old worn out Ford. He never brought me a lousy dime and put it in my hand. So there'll be some changes from now on according to my plan. He's got to get it, bring it, and put it right here, or else he's gonna keep it out there.
That's Bessie Smith. Put it right here or keep it out of there. An example of what Amiri Baraka calls classic blues. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of Blues People, the Negro experience in white America, and the music that developed from it. I want to ask you something.
Yeah.
In Blues People, you say early blues developed as a music to be sung for pleasure, and that was its strength and its weakness. What do you mean by that?
Well, you couldn't make money from it, is what I meant. See, I mean, until you had what they call classic blues, you know, when the women, that period when the women and the jazz bands took it up, and then it could go to these vaudeville houses and on the road, it wasn't commercial in that sense, you know. That was because of slavery. When slavery is no longer, then that music doesn't have to stay on that plantation. You know, like the one-man band, where the even modern drum set comes from. That's a slave who then, coming off the plantation, he's got drums, cymbals, you know, all that stuff that he could put on himself. Those were commercial enterprises, in a sense, you know, no matter how small that revenue might have been from that, but that's what they were, you know.
You talk about the transition to classic blues, and it's primarily the female voice. It's people like Bessie Smith and then Mamie Smith and Race Records.
Lovey Austin, you know, Trixie Smith, all those people. Ma Rainey, all those people. Yeah. That's because they couldn't go anywhere, definitely couldn't go anywhere in the slave thing. So that freed that thing, you know. Like they say, the productive forces were freed by the end of slavery, although they were capped by what we call the Sisyphus syndrome. You push the rock up the hill, they try to push it back down, you know. But that's still going on. The thing now is that there's so much stuff, you know, that people can't see what's really happening, you know. I mean, the problem with the corporate intervention in that, which changed, say, rap, took it another direction, you know. Early rap is not about get rich or die trying. That's something fueled by the corporations, you know, 50 Cent, Lil Wayne, and those people. Or even now you have Kanye West, who is selling Confederate flags, you know. I mean, that's extraordinary, you know. But
I mean, when you look at something like that, do you say, we've come a long way, or what the hell is this?
Well, I wrote a poem about it that begins, who will be the first to slap the shit out of Kanye West? It's part of the whole post-Obama kind of miasma. What Obama thing did was remove, they thought, you know, post-racial. Yeah, post-racial, my ass. You come to Newark, you find out that ain't true. That's the kind of problem I'm on here, because a lot of these young kids really believe that, you know, it's straight ahead, you know, that there is no obstacles to them becoming Americans, you know.
Let's talk about today then, Amiri Baraka.
Yeah.
Because now, you know, by and large, the amount of resources has continued to accrue to some degree, and so has the ability to connect with music around the world externally. So what does that mean for the blues aesthetic? Because I think a lot of people are concerned that there's a danger that it will get lost.
Yeah. Well, it certainly, first of all, is going to find all kinds of new ways to manifest itself. That's without doubt. The thing about the blues is that it's a fundamental, it's like you're talking about the national code in your mind. Like in terms of my own understanding of the blues, I got that from home before I could say blues.
Can you tell me just quickly, I mean, what's a record that you remember your parents hearing?
Well, my parents would play people like Count Basie, you know, and Ella Fitzgerald. See, that's back in those days. But still, Nat King Cole was a favorite in our house before he started singing. And he was a great piano player, you know. Louis Jordan was a famous. Caledonia, Caledonia, what make your big head so hard? That's the cultural basket that you grew up in. Now there's more access to more different things. What will it result in? Well, I hope it don't just result in Kanye West. I hope we can develop access to the world without disposing of our own, you know, historic selves. First of all, everybody borrows from everybody. Every culture borrows from other ones.
Assimilation.
Always, always. There's no way you cannot have that. It's a good thing. It's a positive thing. The question is, why should the Beatles be making $1 billion and Blind Willie Jackson in Mississippi not making nothing in terms of that? That's a social question.
You're talking about fundamental differences between assimilation and appropriation.
Yeah. Well, appropriation is what they do, you know. I mean, even appropriate bodies and slavery. But I mean, the question of if you tell me I learned everything I know from Blind Willie Jackson, how come he poor and you rich? See, that's a social question. And that's got to be solved. It will be solved, but it's got to be solved.
Before you leave, Amiri Baraka,
yeah.
Will you share a poem about music? Do you have one? One or two?
Music. I do an old poem. I did this last night at Raz's He had my son's running for mayor. He had a set last night. This is from a book called Wise. I got that from Langston Hughes. Langston said, if you ask why all the time, you'll get wise. So, Africa. Africa. Go back, Black Sea yourself. Africa. Creator of the human being. Of language. Music. The city. Beautiful ancient Africa. But when you put your hand on your sister, made her a slave, watch out, Africa. Watch out, Africa, the ghost gonna get you. When you put your hand on your brother, made him a slave, watch out, Africa. Ghost gonna get you. Ah! How did you get here? On my back in the dark with the wind and water blowing through my ears. How'd I get on my back? Shango, Abatala, save me. Save me. Isa, save me. Save me. How'd I get on my back in the dark with the wind and water blowing through my ears? At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones. Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble. At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones, black ivory. Wise one, if you ever find yourself somewhere lost and surrounded by enemies who won't let you speak in your own language, who destroy your statues and instruments, who ban your boom baboom, you're in trouble. They ban your boom baboom. You in deep, deep trouble. Huh. Probably take you several hundred years to get out. At the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, there's a railroad made of human bones, black ivory. Black ivory.
Original poetry performed by Amiri Baraka, also the author of Blues People. Coming up next, an exploration of the roots of the blues with pianist Randy Weston and saxophonist Billy Harper, with WBGO's Rhonda Hamilton in the performance studio. You're listening to The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson.
Pianist and composer Randy Weston, welcome back. Great to see you.
Rhonda, it's always great to see you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful to have the both of you here. One of our great masters of the tenor saxophone and composer, Billy Harper, is with us as well. Welcome,
hello,
Billy.
Hello. Yes.
You've known each other now for what, over 40 years, has it been?
Is it 40 years?
I think it was like in the early 70s. There's actually quite an interesting story about how you two first met back in 1972 in Morocco. Billy, you were working with Max Roach's band at the time, and the band came minus Max Roach.
Right.
That was an adventure, I assure you.
Yeah, and this was a festival you were producing in Morocco?
In Tangier.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we had Odetta, we had Pucho's Latin Soul Brothers, we had Mandrill, Abdul Malik, you know, and Max Roach's band, mm-hmm. which is African musicians, you know. So that's the first time I heard Billy.
Yeah.
It was 1972.
What was it about Billy's sound that you thought would make it so compatible with your music?
Well, you know, I always loved that big sound of Texas saxophone players, you know. You know, Jack Head, Arnett Carr, Booker Irvin. I always liked that big sound, you know. And the other thing I like about Billy, too, when he plays, you always get the call and response, mm-hmm. which I think is extremely important in our music. That's forgotten about, you know. All those attributes, plus he covers all the areas. When he plays, he's listening to the music.
But what about this project called The Roots of the Blues? Was this a long time coming?
Long time. I wanted to record Billy Harper. Long time.
But you're going to play for us now something that you said was the first song you guys played together, right?
The Beauty of It All.
Okay.
Thank you.
Randy Weston and Billy Harper, The Beauty of It All Revisited. Billy, what is it that you particularly enjoy about playing with Randy?
I particularly enjoy the fact that when I'm playing with him, it's like we might go all the way back to Africa. I mean, in spirit, in feeling. We go to, it feels like we're talking about history and all the way up. It's just some special thing about feeling. He's sort of a mystic, I guess. Mm-hmm. So we we have a real spiritual connection, mm-hmm. and also to the history of this music.
Yeah. Well, you grew up in different environments. Randy, you grew up in Brooklyn, and you grew up in Texas, in Houston, Texas. And I can't imagine, you can't grow up in Texas and not play the blues, right?
You can't.
What was your experience playing the blues as a younger person?
Well, I started playing at six, playing professionally at 16. I started playing the horn at 9, but I would walk around the city. I'd walk in my neighborhood and always hear the blues on a corner. There's some kind of a joint that's playing the blues, and you hear it. You just can't miss it. So at 16, I was just playing the blues, making a lot of money. I mean, making some money anyway.
Well, probably at 16, it was a lot of money.
It was for me, yes. Yeah, the blues. And I learned a lot about that because that same feeling that was the blues that I heard on the corners was the feeling of the same thing in church that I heard. And I was always there, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm.
And Randy, you played in blues bands, at least rhythm and blues bands, also early in your career, right?
Yeah, my first trip, 1949, with Boomers Jackson.
Oh, okay.
We made the Chitlin Circuit. Uh-huh.
And I noticed there's a song on your CD that is a tribute to Clean Head Vincent, who's
yes.
another great blues player, and from Texas as well.
Yeah,
and he worked in your band?
2 weeks with him.
Oh, okay. All right.
And he played great alto saxophone. He was a beautiful guy, and he sang the blues.
Yeah, he sang the blues.
And I loved it. I realized the power of the blues, because the blues is a foundation, you know. And you discover that in Mother Africa. That's mm-hmm. when we say rue the blues, meaning the blues coming directly from the motherland. And our ancestors carried the blues wherever they went and did all kind of things with the blues. Happy blues, sad blues, you know, you name it.
Right. Well, that's how you're illustrating the roots of the blues in this album through Africa, its connection for Africa and now ultimately all over the world.
I think source is so important. I've always been curious how things begin. And you got to go back to the motherland, you know. And when you hear the tradition of music, you know, it's certainly in West Africa, people like Ali Faka Touré, people like that, you know, you hear the origin of the blues. It's Mother Africa, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the songs that begins your recording, The Roots of the Blues, is a piece called Blues to Senegal.
Yes.
Yes. Can you tell us about this piece?
Well, when I finally had an opportunity to take my small group to Africa, we did a State Department tour in 1967, and the first country was Senegal. The first concert was in Dakar. And we did the history of jazz, which Professor Marshall Stearns had started, you know. And so we did it from Africa all the way to the Caribbean, the Black Church, the Twain, the 30s, and we end up in Africa. It's almost like Africa is the beginning, the present, and also the future. Mm-hmm. And we had a big success in Dakar. And we went to a theater called the Daniel Serrano Theater during the day. First time with the group in Africa, the first concert, and I heard this incredible drummer playing 5 drums. His name was Dudundai Rose, ended up being a tremendous master drummer. So I wanted to write a song about that. So that's what Blues of Senegal is all about. Mm-hmm.
A performance by Randy Weston and Billy Harper, Blues to Senegal. And we've got another piece coming up from the CD. This is a tune called Blues to Africa. Yes. And tell us a little bit about this, because elephants have a little something to do with the intro on this.
Well, you know, I've always loved the elephant, you know, and some people like the lion for Africa, but I always love elephants because they're so huge and powerful.
And they live long as well.
And they live long, you know, and they swing when they walk, you know, because that tusk is going one rhythm. So it's based upon how I imagine an elephant walking, and of course the blues.
Okay, Blues to Africa.
Thank you.
Blues to Africa, performed by Randy Weston and Billy Harper in our performance studio with WBGO's Rhonda Hamilton. Thanks to Jeremy Sterone, the music mixer. Coming up next, Big Sack Butt with trombonist Joe Feidler. This is The Checkout. I'm Josh Jackson. Joe Feidler, thank you for joining us on The Checkout.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome aboard here at WBGO, and you have with you sack butts. Well, you have trombones, but What is a sack butt?
A sack butt is a Baroque instrument, which is actually the predecessor to the modern-day trombone. They're still in existence, but I just think it's more of a funny word.
We have trombones and a tuba, and the trombones are played by yourself, Joe Feidler, Ryan Keberly, and Luis Bonilla, and the tubaist is Marcus Rojas. Let's hear a jazz standard. Thank you. Gil Fuller and China Pozzo composition, Tintin Deo. Joe Feiler joins us on the checkout. He's got musicians from the recording Sack Butt Stomp. Tell me a little bit about what it is that you're seeking with this brass ensemble. You know, like one of the things that I love to hear with this style of a group is literally the overtones of the instruments when they're playing.
I mean, the impetus for the group really was born out of my love of the World Saxophone Quartet. I saw them many, many years ago. I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I saw them there, and it just blew me away how, without a rhythm section, how they could propel a whole set of music and just be exciting and exhilarating. And the idea bounced around in my head for many, many years. How could I make this work? How could my chops get to a point where I'm strong enough to play that kind of music, two sets at a club in New York City? And the biggest challenge is just endurance. I mean, saxophones with the reed in their mouth, even though there is a certain endurance issue, it's nothing compared to a brass instrument. Having the
lips on steel.
Yeah, lips on steel constantly.
You said you're from Pittsburgh. Tell us a good Pittsburgh story. What's it like growing up in a town that has a very great history for jazz?
It does. Pittsburgh is my favorite city in the world still. I mean, if there was a music scene, a viable one, I probably would never have left. I love it there. And I mean, I came up in a tough time when the steel industry was collapsing in the 70s. And the city reinvented itself and now is constantly voted one of the best, most livable cities and best cities. It's fantastic. But the jazz scene from the history of the Turrentine brothers and George Benson and Ray Brown and Art Blakey and Mary Lou Williams, it's the list goes on and on. But that history was kind of fading when I was coming up.
What was the inspiration behind Pittsburgh Morning?
There was two great public stations in Pittsburgh. WYEP had a morning jazz show, and I loved it, and I got up every morning and put it on, and there was this older, Butch Perkins was the DJ's name, and his theme song that he used to open and close the show was Betty Carter's No More Words. I became a gigantic Betty Carter fan, really, because of Butch Perkins. And that tune's loosely based on an old feeling and a vibe from this great Betty Carter record with John Hicks on piano. I don't even remember the rest of the trio, but...
Well, let's hear Pittsburgh Morning. Thank you. Pittsburgh Morning, Joe Feidler on trombone, Ryan Keberly on trombone, Luis Bonilla on trombone, and Marcus Rojas on tuba. It's a big sack butt. Joe Feidler, what does it mean to live with music?
Man, I don't even know how to answer that.
Try.
Okay. I mean, it's all-encompassing. I wake up, it's literally a 24/7 thing. My kind of day job, as it were, is I'm one of the music directors at Sesame Street, and I spend all day writing music and arranging music, and I listen from the second I get up, and there's always the practicing and gigs. It's all around me, and it's what I love. It's just still my driving force. It's healing and entertaining, and it makes me feel good about my life. I couldn't imagine life without it, to be honest.
We're going to hear one last tune, the Sack Butt Stomp, where it really gets into collective sensibility in terms of solos, especially.
Yeah. I've wanted to explore more of that space with this group and not have it be some cacophonous free jazz thing, although I enjoy that music as well, but have us all contribute in a lot of interplay. And the more we play, the more effective that becomes. I think on the recording especially, it's just fantastic. One guy starts a line and gets picked up by another, and everyone has such big ears in the group. It almost sounds like one soloist-ish. And sometimes we go to harmony and pick up and layer things, and other times we break off into connecting these linear motifs. And again, that's going back to the World Saxophone Quartet. Even though I love that group so much, their thing was more like all soloing simultaneously, independent of one another. And I love that, but my concept for this was to have it be more interwoven.
Well, let's hear it. Sack Butt Stomp. Thank you. That's Sack Butt Stomp, performed live in WBGO's performance studio. Joe Feidler, Ryan Keberly, Luis Bonilla on trombones, Marcus Rojas on tuba. Sack Butt Stomp is also the name of the recording from Joe Feidler and Big Sack Butt from Multiphonics Music. Thanks to Jeremy Sterone for mixing the music, and Joyce Kwan for helping to produce this segment. The Checkout archives all of its programs on our website, checkoutjazz.org. You can also check it out now and even share it with your friends. Also, subscribe to our award-winning podcast on iTunes. And be sure to follow us on Twitter, at checkoutjazz. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark, the jazz source. The producer is Simon Rentner. I'm Josh Jackson. Thanks for listening.